Good morning, Oregon. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at offbeatoregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. It's Thursday, so this is an archive show, first published as a newspaper column and podcast episode sometime in the last 10 years. Thanks for downloading, and I hope you enjoy it. This story was first published on July 17th of 2011 under the headline Mariner's Eerie Dream Predicted Shipmates' Deaths. Here we go. Sailors are known as a superstitious bunch, which makes a certain amount of sense. After all, their business is one in which life and death are determined by sublime and inscrutable forces, and you never know when your number will come up. Sure, being careful to always step aboard with the right foot first probably won't help, but it can't hurt, and why take a chance? Still, surely sailors' superstitions don't have any basis in the real world. It's not logical. But every now and then, a story comes along that has to make you wonder. One such story is the disaster that befell the German bark Mimi on the coast of Oregon in 1913, and the nightmare its first mate had the night before. The Mimi was an iron-hulled sailing ship homeported in Hamburg. It was a four-masted, 283-foot, 1,984-ton behemoth, built in 1893, and under the direction of Captain Ludwig Westphal, it wandered in the fog onto a sandy beach at the mouth of the Nehalem River on February 13, 1913. Speaking of superstitions, that's kind of a lot of 13s, isn't it? Well, it didn't seem too unlucky at the time. There it sat, parked on the beach like a stuck pickup truck on a perfectly even keel, a model of Prussian orderliness, even in shipwreck. At low tide, the crew could actually walk ashore. Such an easy grounding, of course, presented a tricky question. Could the ship be coaxed back into the water, refloated, and sent on its way? Captain Charles Fisher, of salvage firm Fisher Engineering, figured he knew just how this could be done. By the way, Charles Fisher wasn't really a captain, he just called himself Captain Charles Fisher. Kind of like how Colonel Edward House called himself Colonel when he wasn't one. On with the story. So Fisher, figuring he knew what to do, essentially bought the ship from the insurance company and set his plan in action. The salvage firm's plan sowed the seeds of a real disaster. They started taking ballast off the ship. 1,200 tons of rocks were trundled out of the ship and hauled away. The idea was to make the ship lighter. Once it was off the beach, the ballast could be put back in. The trouble was, the ballast was there for a reason, to keep the ship from capsizing. And this wasn't just the regular ballast that's loaded in a ship when it's empty. This was the permanent ballast, the ballast the naval architect who designed the ship specified must remain in the hull at all times. Four-masted sailing ships pack a lot of weight upstairs, and their centers of gravity have got to be paid attention to. And it was this fact that was most on the mind of Garibaldi Life Station keeper Robert Farley. As the job went on, Farley made several attempts to warn Westphal and the salvage crew of the risk they were taking, but he was ignored. Crews were racing to get everything ready for the big day, the spring tide, on April 6th, when the water would be higher than any other time of the year, and they'd have their best chance to winch the big vessel free of the sand. Unfortunately, when spring tide arrived, so did a gale warning. A big one was coming in. The ship would have to be floated quickly before it arrived. This news must have caused something akin to panic in Farley. The salvage workers were pulling the ship off the beach sideways, so the incoming breakers would be striking it broadside. Farley was afraid the storm-driven seas would flip the dangerously lightened ship, and he would then be forced to risk his life-saving crew rowing out to rescue people just as the storm arrived, all this in the surf with breakers crashing all around. Farley got on the phone to Fisher Engineering headquarters, but by now there was too much money at stake and too many people wanted to believe he was mistaken. The operation continued. Meanwhile, somebody else was having second thoughts, too. The Mimi's first mate, Frederick Fisher. Fisher, who was not privy to the discussions with Farley, had had a horrible and very specific dream the night before the ship was to be taken off the beach. In his dream, Fisher saw the Mimi as a, quote, dead man's hotel, completely submerged with bodies drifting in and out of hatches. He also, according to Gibbs' account, saw the entire crew with seaweed on their heads and clouds covering their faces, the entire crew, that is, except for the captain and two of the men. When Fisher woke up, he was badly shaken. A nightmare is one thing. A highly specific nightmare that all but lists the names of those marked for death is rather another. After hearing his story, the second and third mates joined him in deserting the ship by making their way hand over hand while hanging from a cable connecting to the shore. If you're keeping track, that's all the ship's officers, except for the captain. Well, then it was time for the salvage operation to start. Heavy anchors had been placed out at sea and connected to the Mimi with thick cables. On board the ship, winches powered by steam donkey engines started reeling in the lines. They tightened, and inch by inch, the Mimi started responding, grinding sideways across the sand toward the open sea. Success was in hand. The ship was in deeper water. Any moment, the sand would slide away, and she would be freely floating. But the wind was already picking up, and the breakers were getting bigger and bigger. Suddenly, the ship was free. She was afloat, for the first time in 4 months, and for the last time, too. The instant her keel was free of the sand, she started rolling in a particularly sinister way, with a looseness that caused onlooking mariners to catch their breath in horror. And then, with astonishing suddenness, the huge sailing ship was on her side, masts pointing shoreward, breakers crashing against her hull. Farley was ready. Against the growing wind and mounting breakers, his surfmen rowed to the scene, but the Mimi's rigging was everywhere he needed to be. Try as they might, the boat's crew could not get anywhere near the Mimi's crew. Remember, there were seas breaking over the wreck this entire time. The boat couldn't go anywhere unless all the oars could stay in the water to hold its position. Some of the spars were flailing around dangerously, and at one point an incoming breaker stood the surf boat almost on its end, a whisker away from a disastrous pitchpole wreck that probably would have added Farley and his crew to the casualties list. The surfmen spent the next 24 hours trying to get to the ship, resting on the shore, trying again. Meanwhile, some of the bystanders on shore were getting increasingly hostile, and Farley was worried about fights breaking out. Exhausted hypothermic seamen were staggering around and slurring their words, leading some people to assume they were drunk. The next morning the seas were much calmer, and Farley and his crew managed to thread the boat into a 10-foot-wide open channel to the vertical deck of the almost submerged ship. There they found just 3 survivors of the Mimi's crew, the captain and 2 of the men. Fisher also survived. The other 17... well, they ended up with seaweed on their heads and clouds on their faces, drifting in and out of open hatches in a dead man's hotel at the bottom of the sea. Among the 4 survivors were the 2 men most responsible for the disaster, Captain Westfall and, quote, Captain Fisher, the head of the salvage firm. These 2, throughout the following inquiry into the causes of the wreck, displayed a jaw-dropping ungraciousness toward the guys who'd saved their lives. Both tried mightily to distract from their own culpability for the disaster by trying to throw their rescuers under the bus. Farley and his men, they claimed, had been timid and lazy. Westfall went so far as to claim the surf that had capsized his ship was, quote, no rougher than the surface of the Nehalem River, and he couldn't imagine why the rescuers had made him wait so long for rescue. Fisher went him one better, testifying in the hearing that the water was quiet as a pond, and accusing his rescuers of having been drunk and attributing the delay in getting him off the wreck to inefficiency and cowardice. It's at least a little gratifying that the investigators weren't fooled by this performance.
The charges of drunkenness were unfounded, their report concludes, and the major portion of the accusation seems to have been voiced by the head of the wrecking firm, who must realize there was criminal carelessness on his part or the bark would not have capsized.
This would have been cold comfort, though, to the 17 sailors and 1 salvage worker who died on that ship and to their families. Key sources in this story included works by David H. Grover, James A. Gibbs, and Don Marshall. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. What you've been listening to is one of more than 500 stories originally created and published in newspaper columns in first-run syndication between 2008 and today. You can read them all at offbeatoregon.com. Offbeat Oregon is a division of Pulplit Productions. Pulp-Lit.com, which is a boutique publishing house owned and operated by yours truly, specializing in audiobook and multimedia editions of the work of the classic pre-war pulp writers. This podcast is covered under Creative Commons license type CC by SA 4.0. Basically, that means you can do anything you want with the content. Reprint it, remix it, add to it, songify it, post it on your blog, fire up the old Cessna and skywrite it, whatever you want to do, as long as you A, give me credit for it, and B, whatever you make is also released under a Creative Commons license. But hey, if you need either A or B waived, hit me up, fj@offbeatoregon.com. Don't let my old middle school principal fool you. I actually do play well with others. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Questions, critiques, ideas for a future episode, or maybe you'd like to get together and have a cup of coffee or a pint of Hammerhead and talk history, email me at fj@offbeatoregon.com. Episodes of Offbeat Oregon History are uploaded around 6 a.m. every weekday, so the next one will be on your device and ready to go before you know it, and the next one will be a Friday episode, which means it'll be brand new. So until then, go out and fill up the rest of the day with good stuff. Bye now.